Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2006. Our session today is entitled, Is It Getting Hot in Here? The presenter is Kathy Dowd. Session number DOC 2006-2. Let's listen in.
It did a really good job of explaining what climate has been like in the past and where they think it's going in the future. And then, you know, what are the causes and consequences of what we think is today's global warming? There was my second choice would be field notes from a catastrophe, and I can't remember the author. It's a woman. I think she was a journalist. And she sort of traveled around the world looking at, you know, what are some
Elizabeth
changes?
Elizabeth Colbert.
What's that?
Elizabeth Colbert.
Thank you. And then there's a third one, and I have forgotten the name, and I've been trying to rack my brain for it, and we don't have the internet here for me to check on it. But that's the one that's been like on Fresh Air if you listen to NPR. And I really didn't like his book, because I thought he was a bit of an alarmist, which I'm really not. Although I believe that global warming is happening, I don't feel an alarm about it, but I'll talk about why. And you may feel differently from me because of my background. I like to see change. I think it's but that's kind of a weird thing. Okay, so I also want to talk about two terms. One is global warming, and the other that you hear is climate change or global climate change. And I'll use those words interchangeably, and some people will choose one word versus another for political reasons, and I don't mean that when I do that. Global warming refers to the idea that the Earth's average temperature is rising. Global climate change, people use that term because even though the Earth's average temperature is increasing, some places will end up being cooler and some places will end up being warmer. So if you just say global climate change, well, that incorporates everything. Because some people think, oh, well, this place is getting cooler, so there must be no such thing as global warming because temperature is supposed to be increasing, right? Well, no, different places are going to react differently. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get into this. Okay. I want to explain the greenhouse effect, even though I have a feeling that you guys have probably done some reading and know this a little bit, but I'll go over it anyway just to make sure we're all on the same page with it. Okay, the greenhouse effect is basically what allows our planet to be at the temperature it is today. Without the greenhouse effect, Earth's average global temperature would probably be about zero. As it is, it's, 57? I can never remember this number. 57 or 59 degrees, one of those. Okay, so if we look at a little diagram here, here's Earth. Okay, and Earth gets its energy from the sun, of course, and the sun, this energy from the sun, it comes down to the Earth, and it's absorbed by the ground, by rocks, by vegetation, by whatever. So it's absorbed by the Earth, and then the Earth re-radiates this energy back out into space. Some of it, not all of it. It stores some, okay? It's this energy that's being re-radiated back out by the Earth that gets absorbed by what are called greenhouse gases. So these are my greenhouse gases. Okay, these are things like carbon dioxide, methane, ozone is one of them, nitrous oxides, chlorofluorocarbons. So there are some
H2O.
Yeah, water vapor is a good one. So there are some that we would consider natural sources and some that we would consider human-made sources, things that come out as our pollutants like CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons. Okay. These guys, they will absorb some of this radiation that's coming off of Earth. Okay. So they let the sun's radiation pass in, but they'll trap some of the radiation that comes from the Earth. And by trapping that, they sort of act as a blanket, and they keep the Earth nice and toasty for us. The idea of the enhanced greenhouse effect then, because the greenhouse effect is a great thing. It's beautiful, we wouldn't want to be without it. The enhanced greenhouse effect is the one we start to worry about. because if you increase the amount of greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere, then they should trap more heat. And that's what we think is happening. So that humans are adding to those greenhouse gases, and we're trapping more of Earth's heat, which is causing the temperature to rise on Earth. And if you look at, you've probably seen this graph. If you look at a graph of temperature over time, for like 1,000 years on Earth, and our temperature records, where we measured temperature with a thermometer, good ones go back to about 1880, 1850, okay? So that's somewhere up in here. Before that, we have to figure out what the temperature was like by using proxy records. So we can look at things like ice cores, tree rings, coral rings. We can look at lake sediments and the pollens in those sediments. And we figure out, okay, if this kind of tree was growing in this area and it was producing pollen that got deposited in this lake, and we can figure out at what age that pollen was deposited, then that tells us something about what the weather must have been like, what the climate must have been like at that time for that tree to grow. Okay. So, and they use about 10, 15 of those proxy sources to recreate the record before the 1800s. And when they do that, for about the last 1,000 years, what you'll see is temperature that's going in some highs and some lows, and then all of a sudden it starts to kick way up there. So that over the past 100 years, it looks like we've seen an increase in the Earth's average global temperature of about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Isn't all that much, but if you think about things like the Little Ice Age, which was a time when glaciers actually advanced, and you can actually see pictures in Europe of these glaciers having advanced, like you'll see paintings of certain glaciers through time, like from the 1700s on to the 1900s, you'll see that they advanced over time and then they retreated backwards. So they kept pretty good records of how the climate was changing during that Little Ice Age. Little Ice Age, it started at different times in different places, ended at different times in different places, but you could safely say somewhere between like 1400 to 1850. The Earth's average global temperature was only about 2 degrees cooler than it is today. But it is enough to get glaciers to advance well beyond where anyone had seen them before that. When we talk about, well, I'll save that. But so that little bit of temperature, even though it's only like 1 degree and that doesn't seem like that much, that can make a big difference, because when it was only like 2 degrees cooler, climate was a lot different. You think about all the things that happened during the Little Ice Age, things like the Revolutionary War, and how they talked about how cold it was during those winters. It really was a lot colder. Even though the average temperature was only 2 degrees, in some places it would have been like a winter of 10 degrees colder, a winter of 20 degrees colder. Because the Little Ice Age probably only affected northern North America and northern Europe in these regions. Okay, anyway, we'll get back to some of that in a bit.
Excuse me, this graph a little bit misleading, though. Really, the noise is much higher, and the noise can wipe out the change, except for the gradual slope of the noise curve. But the year-by-year variation is quite a bit.
Are you saying that I shouldn't be up so high?
Yeah, you should make that noise bigger and have the gradual envelope of
could probably have the noise bigger, but it really does go up sharply like that. And it really does go up a lot higher.
The graphs I've seen has the variation year by year quite a bit. It fluctuates a couple degrees a year.
Mm-hmm. A couple of degrees.
Well, we're talking about 2 degrees total, so the envelope is this big and they go up a little bit like that.
See? Oh, I thought you meant a couple of degrees over this whole graph.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the year-to-year variation is like a couple of degrees, too.
Oh, well, with any of these graphs, I could draw some error bars so that we have something like, okay, here and here.
I'm just saying that the year-by-year varies enough to make the...
I'll try to find at the end for you, like a real graph. I guess I didn't know that I could make overheads, so I could have brought the graph and shown that to you, and that would have been more fair.
It's probably a graph of the global average.
It is global average.
Annual temperature.
Yeah.
Average.
Global average annual, which probably is kind of difficult in itself because we don't have temperature sensors everywhere around the planet, so we just have to estimate.
We have temperature sensors in, I think we have like 20,000 out now, maybe 20,000. The North America is really well covered. We have many in the oceans. Places like Europe are really well covered. It's just places in like the Sahara and Africa. I've seen graphs, maps of them. I might have those too with me if you want to look at that. Okay. Let me see where I am.
Kathy?
Yeah.
Is the increase in CO2 even more serious? I'm talking about Industrial Revolution, about the same dates you have there, and temperature?
Okay.
Or not?
Yeah, let me get to that in just a second.
Okay.
So when we talk about humans enhancing the greenhouse effect, we need to look at what could be the possible causes of that happening. And the one we mostly talk about is the increase in carbon dioxide. And when we look at our carbon dioxide record, we have actual measurements in the atmosphere going back to about the 1950s. And that was when a scientist set up a station in Hawaii to measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And what he sees, and you'll probably not like this graph either, so I'll draw it anyway, and you can hate me for it. But it goes from about 1955-ish to, 2000s up here. And that record, well, it'll look something like this. Like, it'll go up and down, 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 with an increasing trend upward. And the up and down that you see is the difference in seasonality. The one you'll see for Hawaii has much smaller up and down, much smaller zigzag. The one you see for places like Barrow, Alaska, has a much higher zigzag. And what you're seeing is the seasonality of carbon dioxide. So that when you have plants growing in the summertime, they're absorbing a lot of carbon. And then when you have those plants die off in the wintertime, a lot of that carbon just stays in the atmosphere. The overall trend has been an increase in carbon dioxide. Did I write down these numbers? I didn't. But I could look those up at the end if somebody's curious about that. So what we've seen is since about 1850, this is another record that because we only have instruments to measure this, but going back to like the 1950s, we have to extend the record using proxy. So we would use things like ice cores. And basically what happens with those is scientists will go to places that have huge ice sheets, Antarctica and Greenland, and they'll drill down. They have these huge drills that they use to extract a core of the ice. Okay? You can slice that core of ice and then look at any year, really. And the core has rings in it similar to tree rings. You'll get a light layer and a dark layer being 1 year. And then it'll be a summer ring and a winter ring of ice. And you can, even though the bubbles of air are very small, you can extract the gases that are trapped in the ice and determine how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere at that time. The other things that you'll find in those records are things like ash from volcanic eruption will be frozen into the ice as well. So they get a record of a lot of things. So they use that as a proxy record. They use sediment at the bottom of the ocean as a proxy record. And there they're looking at things like the carbon dioxide and the oxygen isotopes, which means that, oxygen isotopes means that oxygen comes in different forms. Some forms are lighter and some forms are heavier. So if you look at the ratio of different oxygen isotopes, it tells you something about what temperature was like at that time. So these creatures that are building their shells with carbon and oxygen from the ocean water, that is getting tied into their shell. So if you look at the ratio of oxygen isotopes in those sediments, as the creatures die and the shells fall to the bottom, you look at the ratio of oxygen isotopes in there, and that'll tell you something about what the climate was like when those creatures were extracting that to create their shells. Okay, so they use several proxy records, and they can extend back the record some like 300,000 years at this point. There was just a really deep ice core that was extracted from Greenland that was recently published. So I think the record goes back like 300,000 years at this point. Okay, and so what we see since about the period of 1850-ish, the Earth's amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been increasing as well. And when you look at the record of temperature and carbon dioxide, it looks like they're both sort of increasing together. You see some things that look like they may not make sense in there. For example, like during the 1940s to about the 1970s, the Earth's temperature was actually cooling, but the amount of carbon dioxide was going up. And some of the explanations for that are that, carbon dioxide is absorbed by the Earth's oceans. And the oceans, nobody really knows how much carbon dioxide the oceans can absorb before they're just going to start releasing their carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide goes directly from the atmosphere and is absorbed into the ocean waters. Okay, and then and that usually happens when the oceans are cooler. They'll absorb a lot of carbon dioxide. When the oceans are warmer, they'll release their carbon dioxide. Okay, and so nobody knows really how much carbon dioxide the Earth's oceans have been absorbing or can absorb before they're just going to start releasing it because they can't hold anymore, basically. Okay. I think I lost my train of thought there, but I think we're good. Okay, so if we look at, well, how can humans,
Is the solubility of carbon dioxide well established?
Is the what?
The solubility of carbon dioxide in water is well established. It seems to be something you should be able to predict.
Right,
well.
But what you have is some of that carbon going into long-term storage. Like it gets absorbed by animals in the Earth's oceans that are turning into shells. Some of it kind of falls deeper into that deeper water. And what we see with the Earth's oceans is that there are some changes that are going on in the currents that may be bringing up deeper water in some places. When that deeper water comes to the surface, that makes it warm up, and so it releases its carbon dioxide. Okay, so there are things happening in the ocean that we don't completely understand, so we're not sure when the oceans will kind of turn the tide and more carbon dioxide will be released by them than is absorbed by them. That's what I'm saying by that. Does that make sense?
I realize there are uncertainties here,
right.
But I think there's other things that can be known.
Okay, so what are you saying? I mean, what are you saying that can be known?
I think it's basically solubility. I don't know. There's some things we know, and some things we don't know.
Uh-huh.
I can leave it at that.
I guess I just don't know what. I mean, are you asking me a question about something I've said, or?
No, it's been a comment.
Okay, so when we look at the carbon cycle and try to understand, well, how are humans influencing the carbon cycle, we can look at several places where we have carbon stored in the environment. One place is obviously the atmosphere, and there are natural sources for that carbon dioxide as well as human-made sources. Another place would be the oceans, because they absorb carbon from the atmosphere, and they also release carbon to the atmosphere. Carbon is stored in rocks, so you'll find it in things like limestone rocks. And limestone is made up of the shells from creatures that had lived in the oceans, and they die, and that settles to the bottom, and over time, the weight of overlying materials turns those sediments into sedimentary rock. Things like limestone. You'll find carbon stored in our fossil fuels. You'll find carbon stored in living organisms. And carbon is going to move throughout the environment, so it's going to move throughout those different storage areas. For example, living organisms have carbon stored in them, and when they die and decompose, that carbon is going to be released into the soil, it's going to be released into the atmosphere. If you have a bunch of living matter that gets buried by sediment, let's say it's close to a river, it's close to a beach, and it gets buried by sand over time and other sediments over millions of years, that can be subjected to high temperature, high pressures, and it turns into things like fossil fuels. Okay, so those fossil fuels, when they're burned, then they release their carbon back into the atmosphere. So the main ways that humans are affecting that carbon cycle and increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, or carbon in the air, I should say, is one, through energy emissions, and a lot of that comes from our transportation industry. The other is through changes in land use, so clearing forested areas and either burning those trees. And burning those trees is one of the worst ways to do it, but even just clearing those trees means that you're removing trees that had once removed carbon from the atmosphere and stored it pretty much over a long term. Okay. The other is through urbanization, where we build cities in areas that had once been open space. And so instead of having vegetation to take in carbon dioxide, we have basically plants and buildings and concrete, which don't do the same thing. Okay. The carbon that comes from fossil fuels actually has a signature, because just like oxygen comes in different forms, different isotopes, carbon also comes in different isotopes. So, and this has actually come out in the last couple of years. So they can look at the ratio of carbon isotopes in the atmosphere, and what they found is that that ratio of carbon atoms that look like they come from fossil fuels has been changing over time, so that the amount of carbon in the atmosphere that comes from fossil fuels has been increasing relative to what we would consider, you know, maybe natural sources of carbon. Things that's just released from ocean waters, or stuff that is released, for example, like when we breathe, okay? That carbon dioxide that we get in the atmosphere, it looks like it stays in the atmosphere for, and I've read, anywhere between 50 to 200 years. Okay. So carbon that we're releasing into the atmosphere today will be there, let's go with the middle number, or something like 100 years, 125 years. Okay. That means that it would be there for probably, what, your grandchildren? Maybe your great-grandchildren, if you think about it that way. All right. So when we think about climate change, what's done is done. Like, whatever carbon that we've added to the atmosphere and whatever warming that we see today and we think is going to increase, I mean, what we have done is done. And the models are converging on a number of about an increase of 5 degrees. So we've, and that's from where we are today, an increase of about 5 degrees by 2100. Those models, and there are, I think, 8 or 10 of them, they're from different countries. What those models do is they divide the Earth's surface up into a grid, basically. And they measure or estimate numbers that will go into kind of telling you what the climate is like at those locations. So let me give you an example. Like, one model might say, okay, what we're seeing is the average global temperature in that part, that grid cell, is, you know, 59 degrees. What we're seeing in this other grid cell is 70 degrees. And they add other things too, like how much cloud cover you normally see at that grid cell, how much reflection you get from the land surface in that grid cell. Okay. So these models, they're going to be using different things within the grid cell. Like, one might look at the reflection of land surface cover, the other might look more at cloud cover. And then those models also have to come up with numbers that will say, okay, how much carbon dioxide will we release into the future? So some models might say, well, we're starting to use different technologies that are releasing less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in order to create our energy. They might make a different assumption on what the population of that region is going to be in the future. They might make a different assumption about a feedback mechanism that I'll talk about in a second. So the models, they'll come up with different numbers about what they're predicting for the future, but they're starting to get close to about 5 degrees. The range is between 2 and about 10 degrees, and they're coming closer and closer to getting on to the number of 5 degrees by 2100. And that can change if we see changes in technology. It can also change as we start to understand more about the Earth's climate system.
That 5 degrees from 1880?
No, it's 5 degrees from now to, from like 2000 to 2100, so in that 100-year time range. There are what are called feedback mechanisms that need to be better understood. All right, and an example of this, a feedback mechanism is something that either it will increase the warming that we experience, or it could decrease the warming that we experience. And feedback mechanisms are very regional kinds of things. You can think about some of them in the Arctic, because that's been a region that has really been changing over the last like 20, 30 years. People have seen great big changes in that. One of those things is that the sea ice has been melting, so there's less sea ice cover in that region. And in fact, they think that they'll have a Northwest Passage open soon, so that we'll be able to ship goods through the Arctic, at least during summers, which is kind of an interesting idea. But anyway, okay, so sea ice has been decreasing in the Arctic. And what happens is that sea ice was very good at reflecting solar radiation, and that kept the Arctic really cold. So the Arctic was a really good thing for absorbing a lot of the Earth's heat, because most of the Earth's heat is going to come at the equator, and it's going to be transferred up to cooler regions, to the poles, through things like our air circulation and our ocean circulation. Like the warm water will be brought up, cold water will be brought down to the equator, and the air will do the same thing. And so it'll cause that cold and warm to sort of be mixed pretty well. So when you bring that warmth to the Arctic, all of that ice and cold temperatures are very good at basically absorbing that heat and keeping Earth's temperatures pretty much steady. Well, as that ice starts to melt, what happens is that instead of the sunlight being reflected, it's now absorbed by the dark ocean waters. If that sunlight is absorbed by the waters, it causes the waters to warm, and that melts more sea ice, which means less sunlight is reflected, more is absorbed, temperature increases even more, and so you absorb more water because you're melting more sea ice. So that's a positive feedback mechanism, where because you get that melting, you're going to end up getting more and more warming over time, right? In the Arctic, the other thing that you see is areas that were once completely tundra, which is basically like low-growing grasses. I mean, you've probably seen tundra around here if you've done some hiking above the tree line. In the Arctic, what you see in the tundra is that it's getting shrubbier. So more plants are growing in it, more shrubs are growing in it that hadn't grown before. Well, those shrubs and plants are good at absorbing carbon dioxide. So the more plants you get growing in those regions, the more carbon dioxide is absorbed, the less that's available in the atmosphere to absorb your greenhouse gases. So you should see cooler temperatures as a result of that. Okay. But as that permafrost area, the tundra and permafrost, gets warmer, what happens is that you get more decomposition of organic materials in their soils. And when that happens, you get more methane being released into the atmosphere. And so that methane is a greenhouse gas that causes the atmosphere to absorb more. So you get more warming. So there's all kinds of mechanisms like that that are going on in this system that aren't very well understood. So when they say something like temperature increase of about 5 degrees in 100 years, that could be way off because of feedback mechanisms that they don't understand. It can go in either direction. It could be better than that for us. I mean, it could be cooler. It could be warmer than that. So they're still trying to understand those things. Okay. What are the consequences of global warming that we're seeing today? What's the evidence that we see today? Well, we see some changes that look like they're consistent with global warming. And some people are willing to say that that is a sign that global warming is occurring and that it's causing changes in the ecosystems around us. Some other people would say that, okay, there are natural cycles that these ecosystems go through, and so you might expect to see some of these changes as part of these natural cycles. Some of these things they're able to look at through the models that they run. And they say, okay, here's what we understand about the natural system, and this is the change we would expect to see in this system if it were just a natural occurrence. And what they'll see is either an increase in temperature in those systems, and a good example of this would be like the Atlantic Ocean. All right, we have an idea of how we would expect the temperature structure of the Atlantic Ocean to be changing if it were just the natural processes that we know about. And what we see is actually the Atlantic Ocean, the temperature has increased in the upper levels about 0.4 degrees Celsius. If we incorporate into that model the things that we know that humans are doing to climate, it explains that increase in temperature that we see. So for that, you would say, well, it looks like then that that is a result of human-induced warming rather than just natural processes. Okay, so there are some things that can look at like that, but there are some things we still just don't understand enough about those systems to be able to say that is exactly caused by global warming or changes. That I've made a little bit of a list. Some of the things we're seeing. We're seeing warmer nights. We see changes in the range of plants and animals, and one thing is that tree line is moving further north in altitude. It's moving further north on the planet, and it's also moving higher in altitude on mountaintops. We see the spread of tropical diseases. Dengue fever has been found at higher altitudes than it had been found before in both Mexico and Central America. We see the lengthening of the growing season in both the mid and the high latitudes, so places like in the United States. The earlier flowering of trees, and fortunately we have records of tree flowering that go back pretty far because people have been in their families keeping long records of when they first saw this tree flower. So that's been a nice record. We also see the earlier emergence of insects. That has been a problem for certain bird species that rely on insects, because even though the insects are emerging earlier, the baby birds haven't started to emerge earlier. So what's happening is sort of a mismatch between the time when the food is available to those birds and the time when those birds are actually ready to eat that food. So we have a mismatch occurring, so that some birds are, the number of animals in that species is decreasing because they just don't have enough food to go around in their early years. I have a good article on that if anybody wants to see that. And then we see things like melting of the permafrost, which is causing all kinds of problems for structures in places like Alaska and Siberia and northern Canada. Because as the permafrost melts, it means that structures that are built on the permafrost, their foundations start to break up and roads start to break up. And you may have seen some of those pictures. And like I said, some of those things they can actually look at, all right, does it look like these are natural causes? Does it look like these are related to human-induced warming? And these things look like they're more related to human-induced warming. When you like sort of run a model and see, okay, does it predict that this will happen, or does it say something else might happen? And try to explain it. Okay. That's it in a nutshell. I want to leave a lot of time to actually talk about some other things. But first of all, do you have any questions on that stuff that I may or may not be able to answer?
Do you know what the trends are on the concentration of methane? And have they been going up also?
Oh, I...
Because that's also a big contributor to global warming.
Yeah, actually, methane stays in the atmosphere longer, and it absorbs more heat, so it actually warms more than carbon dioxide does. But I don't know my methane trends at all. I'll tell you, methane has carbon in it, so it's part of that carbon cycle, and it comes from things like, well, a natural source would be termite emissions. It comes from livestock. It comes from the production of rice as well. I think it's also going up, but I don't know how much and what the numbers are, what even the graph looks like. Yeah.
Aren't there like big pockets of methane under the ocean or something too?
Yeah, there are.
I saw some articles about that a while ago.
Yeah, and I don't know very much about that. Like it sort of condenses into these areas, sort of congeals in certain areas.
And then when it comes to come up, it causes ocean currents to change or something?
Yeah, and that's one of the things they're worried if ocean temperatures continue to rise and that warmth could allow like methane to escape from the ocean, because there have been times in Earth's history where they think big pockets of methane gas have escaped from the oceans, and that could have pretty important consequences. Just the amount of methane that's in the atmosphere, but also, I mean, methane gas would kill you if you were breathing in enough of it as well.
You mentioned the PBS show presentation of global warming. In the question and answer period that I heard, they questioned the assumptions on the records from 1995 to 2000 and the extrapolations based going back to proxies on that. In other words, if that graph from 55 to 2000 could be questioned, then the extrapolations would have to be different.
Okay, what were their questions?
Oh, I don't remember.
Oh.
I'm not a scientist, but I remember that basic concept of it. And I guess my question is whether you have had information about that. In other words, the records that you have now are based on certain assumptions, certain scientific. And what the argument became from a call-in scientist that was sort of on the other side was that whether those extrapolations back, in other words, this is a very small cycle in time that we have records on, are accurate based on this assumptions of this cycle. That's what I understood from that debate, and I don't know all the science. And then I listened to NPR and I watched NOVA. And then and this was a show about 3 months ago, which was a show with a lot of science in it that I, again, didn't understand. But the basic concept was the Earth's magnetic field is reversing. Okay. And there was a lot of cause and effects from that. As I say, I'm not a scientist. But if that is happening, and it happens over a 200,000-year cycle, it makes for any cause and effect relationships different.
Okay.
Because if you have the whole Earth magnetic field reversing that takes up all the land and sea masses, and then, you know, I've been to any number of Native American ceremonies where they say the sun is shooting out those sunspots. And, they have ways of measuring that from long ago. And that's been verified by astronomers at Kitt Peak and our solar center. So we've got a lot of things going on that are at, well, how I understand as a layman, tipping points. So my... you know, or could be tipping points in various short or long cycles. So when I hear human caused global warming, I really have some question marks in my mind.
Okay.
Let's
deal with some of the things you've already said.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, the idea that the Earth's magnetic field is flipping, and it has flipped in the past, I think it was flipping like about every 100,000 years. And it's like one of those things, it looks like we're due for it. And the measurements of the Earth's magnetic field show that it's weakening, and it looks like in the past it had weakened before a flip. So that's why they think it's heading for a flip.
200,000 years from now.
It could take, the range of time it takes for it to flip could be anywhere from a couple of thousand years to a couple of hundred thousand years, yeah. It's not something we have to worry about our compasses being, wrong tomorrow. It'll take a while to happen. But from all I understand of it, and I have done a lot of reading on that, and I did see that NOVA special on that, That doesn't have anything to do with Earth's climate system.
How can you say that?
As far as we know, that's what I'm saying. As far as we know and what it doesn't have anything to do with Earth's climate system. Okay. Now, the thing on...
1,000 years from now is not part of our present problem.
What's that?
1,000 years from now is not part of our present problem.
Oh, but it is.
Not the tipping point, but the process. Let's see, in all these processes,
yep, and
where
never,
are the connected, you know, they're all happening now.
I've never read anything that says that the Earth's magnetic field and its reversal is at all related to our climate system. And I mean, you can believe that it is, and I can't stop you from believing that it is, but nothing that I've ever read about climate and climate change says that it's related. Because we've seen reversals like every 100,000 years, but we haven't seen those same reversals, like the same pattern of changes in climate that are linked to those reversals.
How do you know? You don't know from, that goes back to my question, from this extrapolated record point.
Right. And when you extrapolate these records into the past, they're based on proxy records from all kinds of things, like coral rings, tree rings, ice cores, lake sediments. And you can't look at any one of those things to tell you what the record is in the past, but if you look at like 8 or 10 of them and they're all showing you about the same trend, then that says, that looks pretty accurate. I mean, of course we're limited in what we can know about the past, and we can only do the best we can. And you can certainly say, I don't believe any of this because of that. And
I'm just raising the questions, and what could be integrated with what?
Right,
you know,
and
when
like
you
I
make
said,
like a statement
know.
That it's human caused, I raise a question.
Okay.
It may or it may not be.
Okay.
It may, when you take in some of these other things,
you're right.
It
may
or may
not
be because they haven't integrated and you don't have maybe
right,
enough certainty of the extrapolation of records.
Right, you're right.
Without integrating these other things.
We don't have a perfect understanding of that, and I think every scientist in the world admits to that.
We have to solve present-day problems on the basis of present-day knowledge.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think the case that global warming, to some extent, is true, at least in many parts of the world, is well established. And the question is possibly how bad is it going to be, what the effect will be, but I think it's well established enough we're going to do something about it now.
Okay, let's save that idea for just a minute, because that's where I want our discussion to go. But I want to see if we still have questions about some of the stuff we've
done. I'm not questioning that this isn't happening. I'm just saying, how do you view it happening? See, I'm not questioning that that change isn't it is happening, but how do you view it?
I would view it as a problem.
we need to move on a little bit from there, because we could argue about that for the rest of the hour, but I don't want to waste our time with that. I want to waste our time with other things.
that's what I made the comment that one area of doubt has been expressed in the fact that cities are getting bigger, urban areas are getting bigger, and it's a heat island effect, so that's changing because of the expansion of urban areas, which may distort a little bit of the temperature measurements.
Right, because the more urbanization you have, the warmer the temperatures get around those cities, particularly at night, when those buildings are re-radiating that heat back out. And what they do to try and incorporate that into their models is they take the measurements from those cities and they try to adjust them for some factor based on their urbanization. And that may or may not be a good adjustment. So, I mean, that's another issue that's still trying to work that out.
One of the big uncertainties, and maybe it's not as big as it was, and that's the reason I'm asking, is the effect of clouds, that when the Earth warms, the atmosphere is able to retain more moisture, that means more clouds. More clouds means more reflection of the sun's rays, because clouds are very white, and so more cloud cover means more of the albedo reflectivity, which could mean cooling. So I'm just wondering if...
Okay, and it's worse than that. because some clouds are good at reflecting sunlight, and some clouds are good at keeping the Earth's heat in. So it actually causes the Earth's, like that blanket, to, it's like putting a bigger blanket on the Earth. So it actually causes the temperature to warm. Clouds in the daytime are going to reflect sunlight, make it cooler. Clouds at night will help the Earth keep in its heat. So it's much worse than that. High clouds tend to do more reflection. Low clouds tend to do more Earth keeping in its heat.
So does more moisture tend to favor formation of more low-lying clouds then, making it a worse problem?
More moisture in the atmosphere, in the troposphere, would favor, like our nice big puffy clouds, that would be better insulators. Moisture in the stratosphere tends to favor the high, icy clouds that would reflect more sunlight. So it depends on how that moisture gets to.
Do scientists have any sense as to what the net effect of clouds is, as far as whether it's a net contributor or not to global warming?
As far as I know, it's totally regional and local. So in some places it will be a cooling effect, in some places it will be a warming effect, but I don't think they have figured out what its total effect is going to be. Okay. Here's the next thing I want to go into. How about this? It doesn't really matter if global warming is occurring or not. It doesn't really matter if it's something that humans are contributing to or not. Because the things that we could do, if you believe that humans are contributing to the rising temperature, then you believe that it's because we're adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. If you believe that humans have nothing to do with it and it's just a natural cycle, I'm going to say it doesn't matter. Because the things that you, I would say, should be doing as citizens of this planet will help the global warming problem if it is being caused by humans. And they might just make you feel better, and they would also conserve resources for future generations, even if you believe that it's a totally natural cycle. So what I'm saying is that the things that will help this global warming problem, if it's human-induced, is you conserving energy. So you use less energy, you use your car less, you buy a more efficient car, you have more efficient appliances, you use less electricity around your house, you will produce fewer greenhouse gases. So if you think that it's human-induced, you're helping that problem. If you think that it's a natural cycle, you doing all those things is conserving resources for future generations. If you conserve resources for future generations, you let them have the same choices that we have about how to create energy, about how to, you know, live their lives, build their homes. Does that seem like a good idea, or do you think, I don't know, do you think we should just be able to use all the resources we want because God will provide more to us? Or do you think that our natural resources are a pie that everybody should get their share of, including future generations? I mean, we could use up all of the world's natural gas in the next 50 years if we use the sources that we know about now. We could find new sources that we don't know about. And so we could use everything that we want now and say, future generations can use those new sources that we haven't discovered yet. Fine by me.
Well, I think that it's probably a factor, humans are probably a factor in it. And the one thing that is probably very certain is that more humans on this earth, the more problems we're going to have. So really, to me, the number one problem Earth has is overpopulation.
Okay.
And the other thing is increasing consumption. Now we see that China's, well, they said they're developing, using cars, expanding their car population by 2,000 a day, something like that. India's the same way.
Yeah.
These are huge countries, and they're gonna have a huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, you got, there's certain limits what you can do by conservation and efficiencies. I mean, you can't go more than 100% efficiency. You can't get to it, really. That's the limit. And a lot of people have done studies on what is the sustainable population of the Earth, and we've exceeded it. I mean, this professor, Kripanol, I guess it is, and Cornell University said it's something like 1.5 billion people on the earth is sustainable. We're 4 times that now. We're going to go up to 9 billion someday in the next fairly near future, if projections are correct. And they may not be correct. They may be underestimated.
And some places are actually, their population is decreasing, and they're worried about that, and they're encouraging people to have more kids, like Japan, Russia are a couple of examples.
There's nothing wrong with decreasing population. In fact, I mean, it's something we probably should have to do sometime in the near future, is plan how to do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes problems with increasing older people and things like this, but you can't go on with this Ponzi scheme forever of increasing population. That's what we're trying to do. We got, you know, they say, well, we need more population in the United States because of Social Security. Well, raise the age, for crying out loud. You don't, I mean, there's no reason to expect people to work 40 years and retire 40 years. It's just not feasible, not workable.
I'm not sure I understand your premise initially as you stated it. Are you saying that it really doesn't matter because self-interest will lead us to make decisions individually that should accomplish the same thing, so it doesn't.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
But I don't believe that. First of all, I don't think that has happened or will happen, because some people have very short time horizons in their preferences and in their consumption behavior. They don't care about the seventh generation. And others do, but. More importantly, I think that when it comes to something like the environment, we have to pursue policies described by the bioethicist Garrett Hardin, where he says that we as a democratic society need to engage in mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon. We're kind of going from what another economist called the cowboy economy to the spaceship economy. And the cowboy economy is where it's every person for themselves. The spaceship economy is more like we know we have this integrated system, and we all have to take care of that system because it's our spaceship. And so any abuse of that system is going to affect everybody. And so it's sort of like we have to think of this plan as one huge condominium association, where we basically have codes of behavior, codes on conservation, but we also have to have codes that uniformly restrict what we do. Otherwise, you're going to have what economists also call the free rider effect. So all of us will want to overconsume because we think everybody else is responsible. The free rider effect is one of the reasons why you cannot depend on individual virtue to solve this problem, because there will always be those who will exploit that for their own advantage. And Garrett Hardin was very clear in saying that if you penalize virtue through self-denying behavior, you are encouraging those who would be irresponsible, because they enjoy lower prices, more freedoms to do what they want. So we can't rely on educating the public and hoping that the public will come around through enlightened self-interest in doing the right thing. This problem is way beyond, I think, relying on enlightened self-interest. In fact, we probably have to start mobilizing huge new sectors of the economy to do things like plant trees, perhaps, or do other things. We probably have to impose a serious gas tax to restrict consumption. We have to tax ourselves. We have to impose a fairly wide set of penalties on ourselves on behaviors that add to the problem, like add to CO2 emissions. That's what Kyoto's all about. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's my little.
Let's see. increase on a global scale, greenhouse gas emissions are causing problems. And the question, I think, that comes up is what should we do about it? Now, I have a suggestion which I don't think anybody has made seriously. Maybe it's not practical. But I start with a statement that the more something is taxed, the less it's going to be used. So I would propose that we start with a gradually increasing tax on the use of carbon and I guess other greenhouse gases. Now, this does not have to be immediate, but I think it needs to establish the fact that in the future, the price of carbon-based fuels is going to continually increase. And therefore, people are going to look at this and say, it's going to get increasingly expensive for me to drive a big guzzler. It's going to be increasingly expensive for me to do anything that increases this. Now, what do you do with this money? What I would suggest is that it be given out, most of it, to the people. If you own a gas-guzzling car and commute long distance to work, you're going to end up paying. If you're a little old lady who has an economy car and drives very little, she will get something. The poor will probably benefit from this. The wealthier people are going to end up paying. But I think the idea is to make clear that these taxes would go up regularly, maybe every month. The idea is that people are going to see that using carbon, coal particularly, is going to be increasingly expensive, and they're going to be forced eventually to change their lifestyles to accommodate that. Now, whether this is going to be politically feasible, I don't know, but it seems to me it would be the way to do it. It essentially uses the power to tax
and what politicians
have to long-term burden.
I think one of the keys here is it goes back to what this gentleman was mentioning, but I think economists and sociologists and psychologists would agree it's the sense of community. And what you're talking about is a global community, because we know in all these economic games, and I run these all the time all over the world, the key is you want to form a sense of community. The problem is building a sense of global community is very, very difficult. We could not get the Chinese to stop building refrigerators that release CO2s because they said, hey, you made it to the top of the ladder, why can't we? You know, using the same technology. Now you're telling us that we can't better ourselves by using the same technology because it's somehow bad now? So they clearly don't feel in the same community as we do. And also the idea about population, I'm a little bit puzzled, where I have some doubts about that, because in my understanding, the per capita consumption of energy, of resources, is not directly proportional to the population, but it actually has a more positive correlation with wealth per capita.
Yeah, but you do have a great growing population of middle class people in China who want all the things that
that's
we have.
Right. It's wealth, though. But I'm saying
right, because as they get more money,
right,
and afford these cars.
Right. So it's not just people having more babies. It has to do with their increasing wealth and their burgeoning middle class, right? Mm-hmm. And so every country now that comes along wants to come up to where the rich countries are, right? And so they clearly still don't feel in the same global spaceship, right? So. And I don't know, perhaps, and as you suggested, purely if the rich companies, countries are to say, we're going to sacrifice this. A lot of purely self-interest economists would say, you're going to see more free riding. It's a catch-22, you know? I mean, but somebody has to make the first move, but then what is going to happen? And I think what lies at the heart of it is trusting one another. And I mean, maybe that's simple. I bring it back down to relationships. But someone has to trust us that if we say we're going to do something, if we're going to pull back, it's not going to come back to haunt them later, that we're not going to somehow use that back.
Right, and what we don't even have time to deal with, we're out of time now, but is, okay, what do we get businesses to do? And a lot of businesses are starting to make the changes that need to be made if you believe that humans are causing this global warming, because they realize that, well, for one example, it's costing insurance companies more if you think that, okay, hurricanes are becoming more intense because of global warming. Well, then more hurricanes, you have more destruction, you have along the coast, and it's hard for insurance companies to keep up with the losses that are being experienced there. And you have a lot of other companies that think that they might be sued by certain populations among us because they have contributed so much to this global warming but haven't done anything about it. So you have companies that are sort of banding together to try and do some things, try to be more efficient, try to use resources differently, try to use alternative fuels. And some of that could have a good impact. So on one side, you could talk about what individuals can do. On the other, you could talk about what the business community could do. But we don't really have time because we're all done.